to From Believing to Being, a podcast about pursuing meaningful spirituality after faith deconstruction. We're your hosts.
I'm Karen.
And I'm Dave.
We're two former evangelicals having an ongoing conversation about what life and spirituality look like after letting go of our religious beliefs. Join us as we discuss deconstruction, Christianity, mysticism, enlightenment, and consciousness, and most importantly, how to experience this new way of being in the midst of parenting, careers, and going about our everyday lives.
If you've recently left your faith or simply feeling pulled into a deeper way of being, we hope this podcast will encourage and inspire you and really just reassure you that you're not alone on this journey.
Hello, hello. It's Karen and Dave on the From Believing to Being podcast. And today we're going to kick off talking about some thoughts on suffering, some insights and, I don't know, thoughts that I've had around it lately. And then, I don't know, we'll go from there.
Sounds good. So, I like it.
Yeah. So, you know, you and I have been going back and forth on Messenger a little bit. And I just have been thinking about this idea of suffering lately because of something that happened over this last week. So I'm teaching this class on Tuesdays, and this past week we were talking about judgments, and part of the judgments ended up evolving into a conversation around that greater I, the big I. So we were having this conversation about being the observer versus being in your ego, and how being in that observer space is like being the sky with, you know, with your thoughts and your life basically being like the clouds passing by or the screen that Ramana Maharshi and Rupert Spira talk about, you know, that the what we really are is like the awareness that is a like a screen, and our life flashes on the screen, but it's not actually the screen. It's not actually what we are. So I was sharing this, you know, these kind of thoughts and ideas with my group. And one of my friends who's in the class, she said, so like why should we want to be in this observer space? Like what's the, you know, this awareness space? Like why would we want to stay there? And I didn't just want to feed her the answer. Like I wanted her to kind of sit with it. And we bounced a few thoughts around, but when I mentioned that to you, you know, you had said that, you know, obviously the answer is like, well, the more that you're in that observer space, the less you suffer. And that is what Buddha said about awakening and enlightenment. It's that it signals the end of suffering. And when you reflected that back to me, I thought, yes, I hear that on an intellectual level, and I know that I have felt that and experienced that. But there's something about it, like hearing it again, that is not sitting with me right. And I think it was watching someone else absorb that information and not just be like, oh, that sounds great. That I was like, what is going on here? And then there was another woman that I spent some time with over the weekend, and she was sharing her story with me, and she was not connecting her story to the end of suffering or to like an enlightenment kind of experience. And so I was just sitting with it this weekend or this week and having these thoughts like just swirling around in my head. And what I just now kind of thought about is that it can be hard to identify suffering when there can be so many benefits to it. And the example that was coming to my mind was, because I'm a woman, I will use that as a reference point. As a little girl, I was raised with certain beliefs around what it was, what it meant to be a girl, like what was acceptable for a little girl to do, what made me what made me more acceptable. Like when I smiled, I was cute, and so I got attention. And when I dressed a certain way, it was cute and acceptable and pleasing to others. And so I kept doing that. And I think maybe not, I mean, hopefully not quite so much anymore, but you know, there are these like stereotypes about what it is, you know, to be acceptable as a girl, as a woman, and how you should behave. And if you, you know, if you are more kind, more gentle, more understanding, more compassionate, soft-spoken, more submissive, then there's a, like, you can be more acceptable to other people. And religion, of course, like, puts that on you as well. And so, you know, I became this person who, like, unknowingly, unintentionally became really people-pleasing, like seeking the approval of others. And the way that I got that approval was to always be quiet and sweet and never to assert my needs, never to cause any conflict, to be really acquiescent. And so, you know, I got myself into these relationships where I would just become whatever the person wanted me to be. And then at some point, it stopped making me happy. Like, it stopped feeling good to me. And so I thought, you know, okay, well, I don't want to be this way anymore. I don't want to live like this anymore. I want to, like, I had started to suffer from the very thing that had once made me feel valuable and worthy. But as soon as I say, I don't want to suffer anymore, I want to be different, I lose the benefits that all of that conditioning had brought me. If I stop being sweet, if I start being aggressive and assertive, if I stop dressing a certain way or smiling all the time or keeping quiet about things, I lose all of the benefits that people-pleasing behavior had given me. And so I just had this thought that sometimes, you know, we say that enlightenment awakening is the end of suffering, but that assumes that we have identified that we are suffering. And it can be harder to identify that you're suffering when there are so many benefits to it. And it can even be harder to, like, whenever you do realize that you are suffering and that you need things to change, there can be even greater resistance because you have to overcome all of that conditioning that was so beneficial to you. And I feel like this isn't necessarily, you know, any big, like, revelation, but for some reason, just sort of playing with this and trying to puzzle it out a little bit more kind of set off some aha moments for me as to maybe, like, as to why people don't want to pursue this, or why there's so, you know, there can be so much more resistance to this idea, just because there's like an intellectual resistance, but then there's also like an intellectual resistance, like, well, this is just crazy stuff. Like, you know, this isn't reality, blah, blah, blah. But then there's also this deep inner resistance that is your, you know, maybe like your ego saying, all of these behaviors and conditioning that are causing you suffering have also significantly benefited you and protected you. So I feel like it's saying the same thing almost that we've said before in podcasts, but just it tweaked my brain in a different way this week.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to just think about, yeah, like it's something like Eckhart Tolle talks about a little bit, where he says, whether people realize it or not, they have a resistance to letting go of pain or seeking to overcome pain or whatever, because the pain is their identity. And so, yeah, all this stuff just ties into who we think we are and what, yeah, like you say, the benefits of who we are. So, you know, it makes me think of facade. So, you know, we go around wearing a facade, a mask,
in life. And, you know, that's us making this attempt to be someone that we're not. And one could say that the very act of being something that we're not is suffering. So, but I thought it might be helpful to tease out again the definition of suffering in respect of how it's talked about in enlightenment sort of mindsets, right? So this enlightenment is the liberation from suffering. What does that actually mean? You know, like what, because there's this expression often like pain and suffering, which is actually helpful because it says pain and suffering. So it immediately suggests there's a difference. So I figure, yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. Like, cause in your class and people earlier on to this path of, you know, stepping outside of the self and into awareness or into no self or whatever that resonates, to say that the benefit is to be liberated from suffering is important, that suffering in that context is understood, right? So what are your thoughts on, you know, in respect of this path, how would we define suffering?
I'm having this sense, and this is very new, that what we call suffering is directly linked or has a relationship to the idea of that how things are or how things appear is how they are. So that we cause ourselves suffering when we believe that how things appear is what they truly are. I don't know if that's true. That just is like something that I've been thinking about, because it seems like if we think of suffering as a lot of, you know, as I think I've even said, as suffering as being the mental, you know, the like believing that our thoughts and our feelings are true, or getting, you know, getting caught up in that, believing that we are our thoughts, then that, if that is suffering, that identification, then being free of that is saying, well, we're not our thoughts. And it's kind of like, well, we're not the things that we think we are. Life is not what we think it is. That is kind of the waking up, you know, is recognizing that what we've always taken to be true isn't actually true. And suffering is believing that whatever is presented to us, whether it's life, thoughts, beliefs, words about ourselves, is true, then that is the suffering. And it kind of goes to the idea of separation, right? You know, that suffering, people have also said, suffering is believing that we are separate from everything else. But that's also, well, the appearance is that we are separated from everything else. So if we believe that, then we will feel separate. Whereas if we let go of that, we make room for that sense of oneness with everything, of no separation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is why I think it's good that we talk about this, because I see it quite a bit differently. So we can find maybe a synergy here of different perspectives. But because one thing that I've been drawn to about this Buddhist understanding is that it's actually not, it can be understood without like spiritual perspective. Like,
yes,
I heard somewhere, yes, that Buddha was like perhaps the greatest psychologist of all time. Like,
yes,
it can be, yeah, applied more to human psychology. So you know, even when, yes, we start to get to non-dual sort of talk of everything is connected and all that, like, I think you can genuinely find this enlightenment, this liberation from suffering, even if you don't believe those things.
100%.
And so The way that I interpret suffering in this context is quite simple, and it really just relates back to a lot of what we learn with Eckhart Tolle, is that it's a full relief of seeking and striving anything other than what is. So it's just absolute contentment with this. There's, you know, call it contemporary Buddhist teachers who will say that the Pali word or the Sanskrit word dukkha actually translates most accurately to unsatisfactoriness. So it is this idea that we are unsatisfied with whatever is, and we're seeking something other. And so that's helpful to me. And in hindsight, maybe we just need to figure out a different word, because I feel like suffering has so many other connotations. So maybe just the word unsatisfactoriness is good, because that to me is the benefit of this stuff. Really, it is recognizing that what we are in the ultimate sense is not this body, not this mind. These are just happenings within awareness, and therefore we need not want something other than what is happening, because that's not us anyways. We are just the awareness of it. Obviously, like, that's just one slice of it. It's not that simple. But I think it is that simple to say that when we're talking about suffering, the liberation of suffering, it could be otherwise said as just an acceptance of what is in each moment, and the peace that comes with that.
Yeah, so I'm glad that you said, you know, to tease this out, and that you have a different perspective, because I think that what you're getting at is kind of even what I was coming to from a different way of putting it. Because if it's relief of avoiding what is, well, then we have to ask, what is?
Oh, man.
Right? You know?
A lot of ways of that. Yeah. No. Yeah. Good.
Because because some people, I think, could easily say, well, I look around me and that is what is, without recognizing that they're putting a bunch of labels, that they're bringing this whole other, like, all this baggage towards their situation, instead of just being like, I'm here. Like, you know, with like it being in the what is, without labeling it, without judging it, without bringing to bear, you know, like, all of your thoughts about what this is. It's like, we know when Eckhart Tolle says that, he's already laid this foundation that, you know, that we do bring all of this stuff in. And so you can't really see what is until you drop all of that other stuff. So, you know, so that's kind of where I was going to, like, that what we see is not actually how things are, like what the truth is, because we come to it with all of our lenses on. But when you take those lenses off, then you're in that space that you're talking about, of that, like, pure acceptance of being here without all the labels, like being here, just recognizing that what all of this is just energy, matter appearing in different forms, or however you want to say it, and being and when you sit with full acceptance of that, then there's no suffering in that.
Yeah, no, that's really well said. I think that's synergy. So Liz and I are reading this book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and it's a great book. And synergy is one of them. And I think I may have mentioned this the last time we talked, but synergy is basically this idea. It sounds like this buzzword, but it's a pretty good idea, where, like, you have two different ideas or thoughts or desires that come together and, like, make something better. Because that's a really helpful way to think about it. And it's almost like, so, and if we go to Buddhism, there's eight, right? I believe there's the Eightfold Path. There's the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. Maybe one of these episodes we should talk about all of those, but I'm not well versed at all in that. But I just know in summary what they are, or that they exist. But so there's all these different steps along the path within Buddhism. So it's not just like, okay, accept what is, and now you're good. There are a lot of other processes. And I think what you point out is extremely valid and necessary, because it's almost like it makes it easier. So it's like, we know what the goal is, right? We can see the big picture as the liberation of resistance of what is. But there's all these different things we can do to help that process. And then what you just pointed out is great. Because, you know, identifying what is, or, you know, maybe the better way to say it is shedding, like you said, shedding all the lenses that we've been conditioned. Because something that you said, and I've been really drawn to this pointer and one of the teachers that I've been following, is this is all nothing appearing as everything. And then something you said last time we talked was, imagine the world's biggest microscope, and it's going to zoom down and down and down and down to whatever level of it can, and there's nothing going to be there. And that is everything. So everything is nothing. Nothing is everything. And I think knowing that that is a scientific, I wouldn't say scientific fact, but who knows, it could be an illusion. But as far as we understand science, that is a fact. And so it's just helpful to think that way and be like, oh, like that's what this is. And okay, suddenly we have a better grasp of what it is that this experience is. And then we get to the point of being able to better accept what it is, because it's nothing appearing as everything, right? It's nothing. Mm. Why would we be so concerned about nothing? Which sounds silly to say, but if it's true, it's true, you know?
Yes, yes. It was really funny because in my class, I was trying to kind of get to this point. And so I was like, okay, everybody, you know, look around the room. What do you see? What do you notice? And so we're talking, and I was like, okay, so I see a table, but is it really a table? What is it made of? And people are like, well, it's made of particle board, like pressed particle board and painted. And I'm like, okay, well, what's that made of? Well, that's like particle board is made of, you know, other particles. I don't know. I was like, okay, well, what is that made of? And they kind of clicked on. They're like, okay, you know, different types of atoms, like, you know, carbon or iron or something. And I was like, okay, so really what this is a collection of atoms in a formation that we have labeled table. And people were sort of like rolling their eyes, like, all right, or whatever. And I was like, now let's look at this person. I see a woman. Is she really a woman? What is she made of? And then it was like, their eyes sort of were like, oh. And then we went into this thing of like, you know, and we got to a point where we were like, actually, what you are is just a collection of cells appearing in a particular, you know, in a particular form that we have labeled woman, and we've given it a name. That is what you are. And you just sort of see this like, just not exactly like, I wasn't like blowing their minds, but just, you know, that it's one thing. And this, I think, is, you know, goes to like our attachments in a way, and some of the benefits of suffering is that it's easy to look at a table and to be like, okay, well, I can accept that is a collection of atoms in a particular form that I have labeled table. But to ask me to do that to a person, to look at another human being and say, well, you're just a collection of cells appearing in a form that we've given a label to, I don't like that. It's so much easier and better and more beneficial for me to treat you like you are a separate entity, and that your form actually has meaning and value beyond being a collection of cells, which, I mean, I think that, like, sure, we can make that argument, but it was funny to see that it was so much easier for them to apply that like nothing appearing as everything and everything being nothing idea to a table. But there was definitely like like, I don't want to apply that same thinking to a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Couple of thoughts. First, 37.2 trillion. That's the number to remember. That's how many cells. That's you. 37 trillion, 37.2 trillion supposedly per my Google search. So check me on that. But that's how many cells are in the human body, and that's the person. Like that blows my mind to think, like, literally this is 37 trillion cells. Mm-hmm. So which cell am I? Do all the cells talk to each other and say they're Dave? I don't think so, right? It really does.
Especially when they're competing amongst themselves, like each cell is its own little entity, like replicating and trying to,
And then you get into, like, well, where did the cells come from? You know, when did they become the man or the woman? It's tricky, and I think that's a really helpful pointer to say, we've just decided to label this as man or this as woman or whatever. So that's helpful. But then, to go to your second point, so it's interesting, like, how obvious that is, and yet to go to your second point where it's, like, impalatable, like, nobody wants to talk about that. No one wants to be told they're nothing, right? Or unless they're really, like, either super depressed or, like, maybe
super enlightened,
where you and I are. Well, not super enlightened, maybe wanting to be enlightened. Maybe, like, drinking the Kool-Aid and being like, yes, I want to be nothing, or something, you know what I mean? But again, like, I think you either have the people that, probably the majority of people that just, it's impalatable. And even, I think even the ones that I would say are probably, like, are enlightened or in that space or whatever, like beings that just grasp all this stuff so well, they would never say that either, per se. They would never say you are nothing, because it's just that's void of any meaning, I guess. Maybe, I don't know, I'm probably missing it anyway. But what's interesting is you compare it to the table, and you compare it to animals and really anything other than human beings, and it all is more palatable. And I think the difference is self-consciousness. You know, we as human beings have that. Other beings don't. Our brains have gotten to a point where there is some, I don't think neuroscientists have any agreement about where it comes from, what you can point to say this is the consciousness of the individual. But it's undeniable that we see our physical form, we recognize the thoughts and the emotions and all that, and we call it I, we call it me. And then therefore there is this hyper survival mechanism of that doesn't want to be called out, right? And doesn't want to call others out, meaning I don't want to point at a human being and say, you're just a collection of 37 trillion cells. I could talk about it hypothetically, but I'm not going to go up to a friend or family member and say that to them. So it's interesting, this, like, this survival mechanism of the self, I guess, that has come online within human beings.
I feel like I'm getting a glimpse of what we're talking about feeds into that idea of being everything and, like, caring about the earth, or at least, like, having a different relationship with the environment. Because, okay, let me just talk this through, like, what's going on in my mind. So I'm thinking, other animals, like, let's say that if one dog is suffering, other dogs don't go over and try to help it. I mean, maybe they do if they're in, like, a pack or something, but just in general, the dogs don't have, like, a collective sense of well-being. Whereas humans do, you know, there are these, which is kind of like also sounds weird to say, but there is this idea that like we want our race to survive. There's a conscious effort to continue the survival of our race. You know, it's people are monitoring like, you know, the percentage of growth of the human population and can we sustain it or do we need to have more babies or less babies or whatever. Like there's an active awareness of wanting to continue to perpetuate our race, largely because we think we're superior to everything else. But that's, you know, that's an interesting difference that that we have. And so it's funny because you said a self-consciousness, but in a way it's almost like a group think as well. But maybe the group think is because we recognize that we are self-conscious and we see that as being the value. But anyway, I was just thinking, you know, if you go to that, if you say you are nothing, you're also saying, I mean, it's just like the back way of saying you are everything, right? But you are everything sounds more palatable and fancy and nice to us. But just this idea that like if you really do see that, there's a humility that comes in where you start begin to feel that affinity, that that wanting to perpetuate the everythingness. Which would take away the hierarchy, like the superiority thing.
I remember reading, it's funny how we can go back to some Christian literature and derive pretty potent meaning from it, even like in the evangelical variety. So like two big books that I was reading around the time that I had my big deconstruction, mystical experience, kind of seismic shift of paradigm shift is another word that we talked about, big paradigm shift in my life of like zoom out, like what I had believed for so many years prior to that, I just lost it all very quickly. Anyway, but I was reading two books by like some pretty evangelical authors, but they had a mystical bent about them, so it was helpful. But one of them was A.W. Tozer, The Pursuit of God, and the other was Humility by Andrew Murray. And they're both very good books, and they both speak to what something we were talking about is the four paths of yoga, like these Hindu, this Hindu tradition, and then, you know, there's the Eightfold Path in Buddhism. So like these very progressive paths have these somewhat consistent elements, and there's that, call it bhakti path in yoga, which is devotion. It's like, it's this surrendered being. And so that nothing and everything reminds me of what I was reading in Andrew Murray a few years ago, because he said in the book, I want to be nothing so that God is everything.
Yes.
And to me, in this new space, I'm like, I get that. I don't think of it the same that, you know, the traditional evangelical read would probably be. But I get that in that I want to be nothing so that everything can just be everything. And I will just kind of merge into that everythingness. So like the mystical Christianity is to merge into God. And rather than use the word God, why not just say merge into everything? That sounds great. And I think that's kind of what we're talking about. And when you do that, that is the liberation of suffering. Because if you are everything, what could you want different? You know, what could you be striving for other than what is, if you believe that what you are is everything?
That makes me think of, I mean, Meister Eckhart does the same thing. Like his poems are so beautiful, and his poems are like, or his words, you know, are like empty yourself. The more that you empty yourself of you, the more you make space for God to come in. And the way that I interpret that now is the more that you drop all of the beliefs, that all of the conditioning, the more conditioning you drop, then the more able you are to see that there is no separation, that you are all of this.
Yeah, I think the Christian mystics are so good, and frankly, a lot of just solid spiritual traditions. And the only word that you need to drop is God, because yes. Like what God means is so, like, everyone has a different definition. So if you just drop that, then, you know, replace God with life, with nature, with something that's more inclusive of all things.
Yeah.
It all. I think it all connects. What the beauty of that to me is that there is something authentic about this path, this understanding that there is this merging into the finite individual, perceived individual being, sensing a merging into everything. There's something authentic about that, because people have been talking about it, are talking about it for hundreds or thousands of years. And, you know, and again, I think that to the individual, now, do you lose your individual agency when you merge into the all? That is an entirely difficult, complicated question, because there's a lot of paradox in that, I think. But then the perceived individual in that experience, I think that the fruit of it is a liberation of the suffering, because you just get to an acceptance where, yes, this is all it, and I'm okay with that. But that goes back to your initial point of, like, what is this? That's where meditation and contemplation and all this stuff comes in, is because you can't just, like, all of a sudden get it. I think it just takes a lot of sitting with it and continually just letting it sink in, that whatever this is. And different people have different perspectives about it, but I think it seems like there's a common trajectory for most people who really want to go deeper, rather than just find a theology that they resonate with and stick there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, this is one thing that I was thinking about, is that now we have gotten to a point in society where people are feeling safe, supported, able to, I'm not sure, like, what the right language is, but there is definitely a greater opportunity these days for people to stand up and say, I don't want to accept the conditioning that culture has put on me. I don't want to accept, or I no longer have to believe that what culture and society has always tried to tell me about who I am. And I think, you know, we saw that in the Me Too movement. We got a glimpse of that with the civil rights movement, and then even more so, you know, these last couple of years with Black Lives Matter, that there's this. Oh, and on that point, I just came across a Black woman. She's a reverend. I think she goes by, her name is Deborah Johnson, Reverend Deb or something. If you look up, like, Deborah Johnson, non-duality, she speaks a lot from, like, a social justice place of awakening. But she made this point about how the civil rights movement was a spiritual movement, an awakening movement. And now I can see from this perspective of, it was challenging the conditioning, like the societal conditioning towards Black people. And, you know, and then I think now we're also seeing this in the Me Too movement. We saw this where women were standing up and challenging the conditioning of women and how women had to behave and what kind of behaviors they had to accept. And so I think, you know, that's one thing that I'm seeing kind of go into the psychology aspect of all of this and taking it out of the spiritual, is that you could sort of say that waking up or the end of suffering is just a rejection of the conditioning, whether it's religious, societal, cultural, ethnical, like ethnicity.
Sounds good. I like it.
Does that work? Conditioning that has tried to tell you what you are. When you reject that, that is almost like a waking up moment.
That's, I resonate a lot with that. I think, you know, that we use this word deconstruction. We don't use it. A ton of people use the word deconstruction for, you know, people leaving evangelical Christianity and other, you know, more conservative faith traditions, which is actually another interesting thing that it's like, it's not just evangelical Christianity, right? It's happening in all religions.
Yeah.
Which is neat. Again, it's that, you know, you made the comment about humanity. There's something collective about it. I think that that's true. I mean, we could easily point at the internet as a means of this deconstruction. Yes. But anyway, I digress, because I think in some ways the word deconditioning is actually a better word, because it's not so much. I mean, I don't know. We don't need to play around with the words too much, because deconstruction could mean a lot of different things in different ways. But it's letting go of the conditionings that we have. And I thought something else I was going to say off of that, but I'm kind of losing it.
So I feel like this is like lighting something up inside of me, or a different way of thinking about it, because one of the women in my group, you know, one of the things, like, she left her religion, and she was saying that one of the challenging things for her is that she's a new mom. She's got like a 6-month-old baby, and her religion had told her how to parent. She had gone to, you know, she had been thinking on her way to, you know, to becoming a mom, like, if I want to know how to raise my child well, I look to my religion. I look to my faith. But when you take that away, she was like, I in this place where I am, like, I don't really know how to parent my child. And I mean, I felt this, like, you know, I definitely experienced this when I left Christianity, that for so long I'd been trying to parent under the umbrella of what it meant to be a good Christian mom. And when I walked away from Christianity, all of a sudden I was like, well, what tells me how to be a good parent now? Like, I mean, aside from just basic morality, like, is that enough? And I was just thinking that it, like, just now I was thinking, you know, part of the thing with the suffering, kind of going to the original conversation, is that I think some people, or some groups of people, some more privileged types of people, something like, somehow some people seem to come out with more or less conditioning than others. And I think that, I don't know, I was just thinking, is the way to raise your kids, like what is the most basic level of conditioning that a person needs to have in order to function in society? And like, as you raise your kids, can you give them, like, is that what we should be aiming for? Like, just the most basic level of conditioning. And I think some people are getting there, right? With like this, the whole like gender fluidity thing is reflection of that. It's, it's removing the condition, like removing the labels, removing the conditioning of that. And that makes people uncomfortable. And it's like, oh my God, we have to learn how to adjust and live in this new space where we can't just label people the way that we always have, you know. And you see that too, like there are some people, you know, I mean, even something as simple as like offering your boy child, your male child, dolls, like taking, you know, like playing with the conditioning around what it means to be a boy, what it means to be a girl, just allowing that to even be less stringent. And so I was just thinking, like, what is the most basic level of conditioning you could have to still function in society? And I kind of feel like we're exploring that as a society now, as we start removing the labels and and being more open to those kind of ideas.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think it's a question. I think that's a great question of what is the minimum that we can function as a society, but also what are the positive things we can condition? Because there's something wrong with that. I don't think. I don't know. I mean, obviously you could have like toxic positivity. Like I was joking about like one of my kids yesterday was like, they opened the door, they closed the door, like pointing at somebody doing it. And I was like, oh, you are so smart to be able to, I was kind of joking around, but like that would be toxic positivity. Like actually like praise your child for being so smart for like, you know, just being able to point out something really trivial. But so I was kind of like poking fun at that toxic positivity in that moment. But anyway, and here's my thought. And actually when I was fumbling earlier and I couldn't think of like where I was trying to go with the deconditioning, you know, for me personally, and I can almost certainly say that many other people raised in the evangelical Christian worldview would have experienced some level of this, is shame. Like, yeah. it wasn't even a sense of like accidental shame,
right?
The whole Christian narrative is that you are bad. You yes. are worthless. You are a sinner in need of something outside of you to save you. Like that is the theology. It's awful. It is awful. But that is the conditioning. And I'm sitting here. I kid you not. I'm sitting here, mid-30s, have like, by all means, like great functioning life. I still struggle with this. Like I'm in counseling right now for various things. And after a few weeks, I'm starting to realize, like, this is something that I struggle with. And it's like, holy cow, like, I don't feel that at all. But it's deep, deep conditioning that, you know, that stuff that my parents would tell me when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, not like, you are worthless, but that teaching of the theology. It's just awful. So, in that respect, like, that is obviously a conditioning. But can we do the opposite? And I think that we can. And maybe that's not even conditioning. Maybe I'm just like throwing it out the door there in a way, but to say that you have value, you have worth, basically the opposite, that you are safe, you are secure, like really ingraining that sense of solidity of value, of acceptance. I don't know. I don't know if that's even something we need to make efforts to do, or if that's just the natural outpouring. Again, like, because I love your question, like, what is the minimum amount of conditioning? And maybe it's not even the positive things. Maybe it's allowing the positive things to happen organically. I don't know.
Well, I think it's tricky, right? Because first of all, we have to identify our own conditioning, because we're going to parent from from our thoughts about conditioning. And I think too, like, I hesitate to say positive, because I feel like if you're chasing after the positive, you're also chasing after the negative, right? That like,
right, how you're implying it.
How can we know? I mean, and I think, but getting to your point though, I don't know that it's even, I don't think it's definitely not possible to come out with no conditioning whatsoever. It's like, as long as you're alive in this world, whatever it is, you're going to be under the influence of something. Even if you're like raised in the wilderness, you're going to have the conditioning of whatever, you know, whatever those influences are. So there's always going to be some sort of conditioning. And it's interesting, because it's almost like the conditioning that we have to allow is whatever is naturally in the person. Because that's what we're finding, right? Is that the more of my conditioning that I drop, the more that I show up as what I really am. And I think that we see that with our kids too, right? It's like our kids have a way that they really are. They have things that they're drawn to. They have gifts and natural abilities that they express. But we can, you know, we and society and whatever other influences they have can condition those out of them. And not by necessarily even doing anything, but just putting layers of approval or, you know, approval, disapproval, you know, all that kind of stuff on top of them. And so it's almost like, how do we let our children, yeah, I mean, it is kind of like, what's the base level of conditioning? It's like, how can we put the fewest parameters on them, on who they naturally are?
Mm-hmm.
But in order to be able to do that, we have to be super tuned into what parameters we put on ourselves. Like, all that.
And there you go. There's another, you know, for people interested in what the benefits of this is, that's another benefit, right? Call it liberation of suffering, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, to step into the big I, the awareness, the deep self, the true self, whatever word we want to label it, it's all the same. I actually kind of like true self, soul. There are all these words that point to the same thing. But stepping into that space of awareness, consciousness, helps to unravel some of these things. So one thing that comes to mind as you're saying this is the idea of personality. It's something that for me personally has really resonated these last few days, because when you start to step into identifying as the all or the nothing, right? And that's kind of the path of what I'm finding, is you either have people ultimately identify as the self, the all, the God, the awareness, or they decide to drop everything, to drop identifying as anything. And I'm inclined personally one of those paths, but like, I think they're both valid. And, but the risk that is run is like, okay, what about my individuality?
Yeah.
And something that's helped me a lot is, yes, screw the individuality, because it's based on conditioning.
Yes.
That you are a separate individual is conditioning. However, personality is not. Personality Ooh. Is what is arising, right?
Yeah.
That, because that is undeniable. We can question all we want that, like, this body, mind, whatever, is like some separate consciousness. We don't know. But we know that it's a personality. Like, this Dave has a personality. And as you point out with our kids. So a couple of thoughts, I guess, as we tease this out, is like, what do we condition? Well, I guess that's not really conditioning. It's allowing the personality to be just as it is, which can be hard because of our own conditioning, right? Like, my daughter loves wearing dresses. She just gets so excited. And every once in a while, my son will wear dresses and, you know, I have no problem with it. I'm like, yeah, go for it. Except for, like, deep down, there is a resistance. It's like, boys shouldn't be wearing dresses. But anyway, so that's to your point. But so I think there's this, we should allow personality to flourish. And it's like, the more that the conditioning goes, the more the personality flourishes, which is beautiful, because that is what this is. But then I will just say, I think it's probably important to mention, to, I guess, my opinion of minimum conditioning is what maybe Christianity calls the moral law. So again, maybe it's not a conditioning. Maybe it's just something that's learned by the very nature, but it's things like don't do harm, don't lie, don't steal. Like, those basic things I think are important that we, you know, I don't even know if you'd call that conditioning, maybe, like, right and wrong in a way, but like right and wrong in the sense of like hurting other people is wrong, stealing from other people, lying to other people, that's wrong, but that keeping that as minimal as possible. That's at least what arises for me in terms of basic, like, minimal conditioning.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea, right? Like I just thought of the Lord of the Flies thing. Like if people were left to their own personalities, like if everything was allowable, if everything was allowed, where would we, you know, where would we end up? Mm. If personalities were allowed to flourish. Mm. But again, I think like that's just, you know, a false thought experiment, because as long as you're in a group, you're going to be influenced by other people's personalities and mm-hmm. you know, mess with that. But would we just end up destroying ourselves?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, which is an interesting an interesting thought. So yeah, so maybe it does have that element of like allowing personalities to flourish without conditioning, but in order to enable all personalities to flourish, mm-hmm. you do have to have certain ground rules, like what we've ended up with a lot of the laws, right? Is that, mm-hmm. you know, you can go as fast as you want on a road until your speed begins to threaten the life of someone else. And so that's why we have speed limits and, you know, bumping up against some of those laws.
Yeah. And another thing coming to mind, and maybe we should link this in the show notes, but it's this, it's actually kind of funny. I was watching some just variety of non-dual videos on YouTube, and all of a sudden this video from Yuval Noah Harari got recommended, and it was Yuval Noah Harari is somewhat well known. He wrote the book Sapiens, and I think I don't know exactly what he is in terms of profession. I think he's maybe in academia. Just really, really sharp guy, historian, I guess you'd call him. But he had this video, this TED talk about something about how this is how human beings have become to dominate the planet. And what was funny about it is he was basically saying that human beings live in duality. So that was the funny part. I'm watching all these non-dual mm-hmm. videos, and then he's like, humans are successful because of dualism. I'm like, whew, something I need to chew on. Because, and he makes a good point, is we have these belief systems that aren't actually tangible or real, but they are what makes our society work. And the one, and again, you could call that conditioning. And he said the most significant one is money. For example, you could go anywhere in the world, and an American dollar is going to be valuable. Right. But if you go to chimpanzees and offer them a dollar bill for a banana, as he says, they're not going to trade, right? Yeah. They chimpanzees, animals of any kind, don't have some shared belief system about money. Therefore, they can't organize, and they cannot, you know, and that's what it is. We as human beings can organize and support the collective whole, and here we are. 2022, like absolutely dominating the planet for the last however long.
You know, it's funny because money is just a symbol for something that we find valuable. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what is his mm-hmm. point, right? Is that yep. other species.
It's a belief system. He calls it a belief system.
Yeah, it's a belief system around what is valuable. And yep. it's interesting yep. because so many other things. I mean, that's like the big abortion debate right now is like, what is valuable? And yeah, that's interesting that we've been successful because we've created a shared belief system around what is valuable. And as soon as you say something is valuable, you automatically enter duality of like, this is valuable, this is not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny because then it's like that. It builds this amazing structure that we live in, and yet I think it causes suffering to what we're talking about, a lack of content. Like, I don't think animals, I don't know if animals suffer at all, to be honest, in the context of understanding like animals wanting something else.
Right.
You don't, yeah. I don't think animals go around thinking like, oh, if I only had this, then I'd be happier. If only this, or I really am anxious about X, Y, or whatever. But you know, we as humans have that. So it's almost like we have this dualism that has built up our collective ego, if you want to call it that. But then to step into the non-dualism, maybe you lose some of that. Like you were saying, the benefits of it, you lose it. And yet you find peace, contentment, all that.
So, I mean, in that sense, deconditioning, what we're talking about, deconditioning is a rejection of that shared belief system. And so it's a, that's, I mean, and that goes to the benefits. Like if human beings have been so successful because we've built this society based on shared beliefs and values, but the liberation comes the more that we reject those values and belief systems. Yeah, that's interesting. And it makes me think, you know, of Power of Now again, how, you know, he's always saying like, the more that you're chasing one thing, you're just as you're, you know, you're setting yourself up for the opposite. And that's kind of what we see, right? Is that like the more that we've chased this, these are the things that are valuable, we have ended up in a situation where the things that we didn't value are now coming back to bite us in the butt, right? It's like, well, we valued progress over the environment, but now we're coming back and we're having to deal with climate change and with lack of water and with deforestation and all of these things that, you know, that now are becoming matters of like utmost importance because they weren't. And it, I mean, it does, you know, like we were talking in our unpublished episode, I was talking about like not the cyclical nature, but like that, you know, where does East meet West, like the bumping into things. And it feels a little bit like that, because I think if you know, it's just like what I was saying, that if we all went to the complete opposite and like totally deconditioned everything, and it was just personality was allowed to flourish, we would probably end up in like a Lord of the Flies situation, which isn't what we want. So we necessarily need structure. We need a shared value system. Then the shared value system, like if it grows too big, we have to decondition from that. And I don't know, it is kind of that question of like, you know, where is the point of deconditioning to a unharmful state, to a deconditioning to a point where you're not suffering. But if you go too far, then you would create you would create a different kind of suffering. I don't know.
No, I mean, I follow you 100%. I don't know. I mean, I'm encouraged that, you know, so I don't want to say I'm channeling the inner conspiracy theorist. I think all of us have an inner conspiracy theorist to some degree. Like we're always like, like, what's happening in the world that is nefarious that we don't know about, or how are we being lied to? But anyway, one of the big conspiracy theories is that there's some sort of like powerful group of people that's exerting influence over the world, blah, blah, blah. It's interesting. Maybe it's true. Maybe it's not. I don't know. But one of the ones that gets pointed to a lot lately, it's called the World Economic Forum. It's a kind of a not super known organization, but it has a lot of power and influence. It has a lot of influence over large corporations and government. And this Yuval Noah Harari is a key advisor to the World Economic Forum. I understand that the there's some like Indian sages that have consulted and advised. So here's my thought is like the World Economic Forum is like seemingly tremendously influential because they have their influence over mega corporations, big government, all that. And my hope, my optimism is that they have people like these spiritual leaders and Yuval Harari that understand exactly what we're talking about, right? And that's kind of the neat part is like, I have faith that like there are people with high influence on in our world that get this. And can there be a solution that globally a shift, right? A transformation of how the world operates that meets this, right? Exactly what you're talking about. How do we minimize the conditioning of humanity, the need for conditioning maybe with the minimal amount to still function as a whole, but give people their personalities back, right? Because maybe that's the simplest way of saying it is we're so deeply conditioned by all these beliefs that we don't thrive as the personality that's there, and people are somewhat miserable because they're just faking who they are to conform with society.
I love how you brought that out about the more that we drop conditioning, the more that our personality flourishes, and that the individual, like the sense of individuality, is based on conditioning, but our personality is not. And I think maybe, you know, what we see is that I don't know if it's just like inherent in humans that at some point personality and the desire for individuality seem to merge. I mean, that's kind of even like the space where you are, right? Like that 2-year-old space, like you see their personalities, but you also see the individuality, like the mind, me, I want to do it myself, like all of that stuff really starting to be expressed. And it's like, well, you don't want to decondition that out because there is some element of that that has to be there in order for the personality to be expressed. I don't know. So who knows how those things like really go together. It does make me, I was reminded as you were talking, you know, and this is something I feel like I have not, that I don't fully experience yet, but this idea that so many of the spiritual teachers talk about, that the nature of the all or the nothing is love, which I would interpret as like total surrender, right? I think you could say surrender, acceptance. And if that is what we are, if you decondition everything, is that where you would end up? But what even would that look like? And that it almost is strange because total, like if the entire world, if everything in the entire world was totally surrendered, could the illusion of this appearance actually exist? Because taking on a form is almost necessitates resistance.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a tension. Mm-hmm.
And so if everything was fully surrendered, we wouldn't have an appearance at all of anything.
Well, so where I go with this is there is a drop, when you drop any sort of identification So again, I'm if you think of the non-dual path as like either there is the all that is everything, that is what we are is the everything, or the other path is the nothing, and that's what I resonate with more, because to me what that says is, what it suggests is that everything is happening, but there's no one doing it. There's no one steering the ship. There isn't a sentient being in existence. It is just the appearance of sentient beings. And where that starts to connect for me in terms of this unconditional love, this unconditional everything, freedom of this, is that it really just is an expression of this, that everything happening is an expression of the nothingness, right? And there isn't any being that is having the experience. It's just happening. And in that respect, there isn't any being to judge it. There isn't any being to judge if it's good or bad.
Yep.
Because you use the example, if you take away conditioning, I think animals are such a good example. You would not call packs of chimpanzees love. Like they are violent. I mean, they do some really heinous things. But maybe you could argue that there is some sort of conditioning there. But I think that to me, and where my path starts to diverge from like a lot of these paths, is it, I find a point of absolute acceptance even in the chaos. I don't need some sort of like utopian society, heaven, Garden of Eden, whatever, as some sort of end destination. I just, you know, maybe it'll happen. I don't know. But that becomes more of like, to me, a religious belief. Whereas to just accept and surrender to this happening, and just allowing it to happen, not making any judgments about it, stepping outside of any sentient being that is aware. Again, that's helpful to me. That's where I'm finding that, like, I've had these connections where it's helpful to me, but then I find, like, that's not necessarily helpful to others. So there's this sort of ether out there of, like, how do people best connect with this? And that's where I like that four yoga paths, because I think some people just want there to be a God that they can just surrender to, that they can say, I want to be nothing so that you are everything. And that's the same thing. They're doing the same thing I am, just with different words.
Right. And we could, you know, I mean, we have used these words like consciousness and awareness and, you know, these different things, but really it all comes down to, as far as like science is concerned, mm-hmm. energy, and that we can't, right. and consciousness is energy acting in a way that we don't understand.
Mm.
Yeah. Or whatever we call energy acting in a way that we don't understand. And I think that's where people get into like the quantum physics, is because quantum physics studies energy acting in ways that mm-hmm. we don't understand. And, you know, and right. we get to that point. But yeah, and I think it's one of those things, like, to just come to a point where you say, what this is that is called, or that is known as Karen, this, like, it's just energy appearing as a form, acting in a way that we can't scientifically explain. But we've created all of these stories around what it is to be that form of energy acting in a way that we can't understand. We've created all these stories, but if you drop the stories, and the thing is that the stories have benefited us. The stories have benefited us in different ways, and that it's not fun to just be like, well, I'm just energy. Cool. Like, you don't want to go there, because it's like, you know, you don't want to go there. And but if you do go there, all of a sudden there is a freedom of like, if I'm just if I'm just energy, then like, I don't need to get so caught up in shame or embarrassment or guilt or whatever, because like, it's all just energy. And at the end of the day, it's like the total surrender of like the absolute like non-resistance of this form, the total surrender of it is death to the form, not death to the energy, death to the form. And there's like a strange freedom in recognizing that, although it is not easy, and you know, the form can experience pain, and nobody wants that. And yes, I hope that whenever I do, this body does die, it's peaceful. It's just like going to sleep with no pain involved. Like, absolutely, I would want that for myself.
Yeah. The word that arises when you said that, you know, no one wants to hear that they're just energy. The word that arises right there is nihilism. And I've been pondering this a little bit lately, this idea of nihilism. And I have my own sort of definition now on nihilism, meaning that one would say that nihilism equates to someone, or I'm sorry, nihilism equates to a position that says life, nature, existence has no inherent meaning or purpose. Okay, that's nihilism. But what I say is the state and the condition of nihilism is only there if you're looking for meaning and you don't find it. But I think in this understanding, it is just the recognition that there isn't any inherent meaning. It is just energy, but meaning is created from it. So it's like, again, it's kind of back to that nothing becoming everything. It's like, inherently, it is nothing. It's just energy. Nothing other than that. That is nothing. Everything that is energy, period. There's no meaning to that. And yet, out of it comes everything. Every meaning that ever has been comes out of it. So again, mm-hmm. It's like, you could say it's nihilism. And I think that that's an important juncture on the journey, if I'm being honest, because I experienced a little bit of that probably about a year ago when I first really started to step into this stuff was, okay, so there's no meaning. There's no purpose to life if that's all this is. And I think that that's just it. Maybe that's the dark night of the soul, is we are conditioned to find all these different ways of meaning. And then it's like a wake-up call when you are realizing that everything that you derive meaning from isn't – it goes back to what you were saying. It's not what this actually is. It's mm-hmm. what's appearing. So you almost have to go back through it and say, well, what is this actually? And sit with it and sit with the misery of that and then come yes. out the other side and realize, yes. oh – okay, like this does have meaning, just not in the way that I thought. And like the tension is released, right? The tension of like needing it to have meaning is released. Needing to find meaning is released because you understand there is no inherent meaning. And yet when meaning arises, there it is.
Yes, yes, yes. I love everything that you just said. I feel like you nailed it. And because it does seem like that is, I mean, there's lots of points along the deconditioning type of journey that, you know, feel like death. And it does seem like yep. this is, you know, that this is one of those things. It's like, okay, well, take everything away. Like, you can take everything away, but like, please tell me that my life still has some purpose. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it doesn't. And you have to sit mm-hmm. with that. But then once you go through that and you, and like you said, like you really sit with that and let that sink in, then there is a freedom that's like, well, if it doesn't have any inherent meaning, if there is no like reason why I'm here, well then screw it. Like I can make up my own meaning. I can decide for myself. Like I can be whatever I want to be. And there's like a strange freedom, but you can't really have the full experience of that freedom if you don't sit mm-hmm. in that space Yeah, that's so good.
That's what I've heard is when people talk about unconditional love, that's kind of what they're pointing at, freedom. There is the freedom in this all that is energy. There is the freedom for it to be whatever it wants.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know, not that we need to personify it and say it has wants, because
right,
who knows about that. But the reality is anything can happen because mm-hmm. it's just energy appearing as this. So truly anything could happen. And that's freedom. And that's unconditional love is, again, how it's constrained. It doesn't quite connect for me intellectually, but there is that inner yearning for love in all these different traditions, and we all feel it. So there is a resonant there, even if it doesn't intellectually make sense.
Yeah. You know, the thing that is coming to mind is that, which I feel like we interpret in different ways, this whole year is, you know, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. Yeah. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. Like before it doesn't, you know, before it has one meaning, and then after it has a totally different meaning, but yet it's the same activity. And
my perspective is that before enlightenment, you carry wood and chop water. After enlightenment, water is carried and wood is chopped, but there's no one there. Yeah. It's just something happening. I know that's not the actual saying, that's Dave's derivative of it, but again, it helps to cement this understanding that we can be whatever we want. We don't have to be limited to this or that or whatever we are. We are energy appearing as everything, and that's freedom. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Even though if it's scary, but I think to your point, like sitting with it can be hard, but yeah, I think it does lead to a sense of freedom.
Wow. For not really knowing what we're going to talk about, I feel like that was an exciting podcast for me.
Episode. I feel lighter.
Yeah.
I feel lighter. I had a friend tell me the other day, we were talking about enlightenment. It keeps coming up lately. And normally I'd rather not use the word because it's just so loaded. But he said he used to think of enlightenment as like there's this light, you know?
Yeah.
But he's like, I wonder if you could say it means like you are lighter.
Yeah. Like, yes.
Oh, I like that. I like that because I feel lighter. This is a good, nice conversation. And I feel like I'm not hovering off the ground, but I feel a little bit less dense.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Or even like you let more light in. Maybe there's not a light that you're going towards, as that you're letting more light in because you're not as full up of conditioned stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
So again, thanks everybody for listening. You know, we hope you resonated with some of this. As always, you know, this can be kind of out there stuff, and you know, definitely not something to be processed alone, if at all possible. So, you know, feel free if you're really sitting with this and chewing on it and you want someone to talk to about it, you know, feel free to send us an email at frombelievingtobeing@gmail.com. or find us on social media or whatever. We'd love to connect. And yeah, we'll leave it there. So thanks again for listening.